Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is author Jeremy Dauber. He is a professor of Jewish literature and American studies at Columbia University, and we're talking about his latest book, American Comics, A History. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a real pleasure to be here, too. I'm so glad we're doing this.
I was shocked how much ground you covered in this book. And I've covered histories of comics before. But you basically decided to do the whole shebang. Graphic novels, you name it, like from the very beginning. What inspired you to take on such a huge topic?
Well, you know, I've been very lucky that over the last 10 or 12 years, I've been able to teach a class on comics at Columbia, co-teach it with the former head of DC Comics, Paul Levitz.
Oh, yeah.
So that's been a really cool experience. And, you know, before that, I was a big fan as well. And you know, I was just a fan of the whole shebang, you know, as you put it. And to me, you know, that really was the story, was just that it was all part of this one big tapestry. And I really hadn't seen a lot of books that really tried to tell the story in that way, you know, really just showing how related everything was to each other in some fundamental ways. And so I figured I might as well try and do it. But then, as you say, it's a lot of ground to cover, as it turned out. So
I want to say it's a huge book. It's an ox stunner.
Well, and you will not be shocked, since I know you know the field, to know that it was originally even much longer than that.
I know. I had no doubt. I had no doubt. you talk a lot in the beginning. We're only going to talk about the very, very beginning of the book. You know, you talk about antecedents to comics, things like broadsheets, print series by Hogarth and stuff like that. But the book really starts with Thomas Nast. And unfortunately, so many listeners may not know who Thomas Nast is. Can you talk about that?
I'd love to. Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right. That's really, you know, there's a little bit of a precursor to trying to figure out these antecedents. But Thomas Nast, this amazing figure in American history, who is not as nearly as well known as he used to be, is really where the book gets going. Nast was a cartoonist. He drew cartoons for mostly for a magazine, Harper's Weekly, which is still around today. And you know what, he did it around the time of the Civil War and through sort of a large chunk of the second half of the 19th century. And what he did was really help make comics, American comics, into sort of a national political force. And he did that in a couple of different ways. Maybe the most important way was that he drew these series of cartoons that helped bring about and consolidate Northern support for the Civil War. And he did that by really sort of putting together sort of, you know, the reasons and the causes for the war and the need to support it, you know, in these kind of indelible images. And one of them, which was about Santa Claus, or a Christmas time illustration, Santa Claus visiting some of the Union camp, also showed the other side of what he did, which was so important, which was he helped create and concretize these iconic images of things like Santa Claus and Uncle Sam and the Democratic Donkey, right, all these things. So just showing the power of comics in America as a kind of nationally shaping force.
A quote from your book, Nast is a strong proof that an image's power is multidirectional. He also was the one that, it was Boss Tweed that he did a lot of comics about, didn't he?
That's exactly right. Yes, exactly. So a little bit after the Civil War, he was really a New York cartoonist. He was an immigrant, like so many people in the story of American comics. But a lot of his time was in New York City, and he took on the kind of machine politics,
right.
And that was centralized in this guy Boss Tweed, who basically ran a lot of New York City through Tammany Hall. And you know, Tweed very famously sort of said, he said, "My constituents can't read, so I don't care what most of the newspapers say about them, but they can look at pictures." And these pictures that Thomas Nast drew of him with like a sack of money bags for predatory talk. Yeah, that helped eventually lead to his sort of disgrace and fleeing the country. So Nast was a superhero of his own kind.
One of the great things about your history, American Comics, is that it continually emphasizes the importance of immigrant readers in the early history of comics. That I have not read before.
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things, and you know, teaching this with someone who had been in the business of comics really helped me think about this a lot, is that, you know, a lot of the history of comics is also about the institutions and the business of comics. And so for people like William Randolph Hearst, like Pulitzer, you know, these were also, to do comics was also a big business decision. How do you sell more newspapers? And part of that was saying, well, our product is really composed a lot of words. And for people who are immigrants who are new to the English language in many cases, you know, or their kids who are new to any written, you know, language, pictures are really appealing and attractive. And that's going to get people to buy more newspapers. And so that becomes a major part of the start of the golden age of comics, in my opinion, sort of these newspaper comic strips that really start flourishing right around the turn of the 20th century.
I also, as an aside, I want to mention that yours is the only history, I think, that really continually points out racial ethnic stereotypes found in the comics of the time. And you talk about them. And I think that's really important, and I'm really glad you did it. But it's interesting. I think that's the first time that it was so much sort of into the forefront and made very clear.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's been wonderful over the last 10, 15, 20 years is there's been an explosion of research into some of this stuff. And, you know, these general, you know, to tell the real story, you know, you can draw on some of that research, but also really say this is a central part of the story. And it's a way of thinking about American culture more generally, which comics is, of course, a central part of saying, to really think about these questions and about what these kind of representations meant and they did in American culture and American society at the times.
Now let's talk about the Yellow Kid. That comic still is wild looking.
It is wild looking. And I think that, you know, I think I say something in the book about, you know, it really has the raw energy of the American streets.
It really right? does. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Richard Felton Outcall. How would you pronounce his last name? I've never been sure about how to pronounce his last name. Outcault?
Yeah, Outcault. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And to me, you know, this guy really is such an incredible figure because he brings some of this spirit of kind of the, you know, almost reportorial illustration. Right. He used to be a sort of a professional illustrator back before photography really was a big thing. Right. And this kind of incredible, almost chaotic street-like energy and kind of puts them all together in this image. And particularly in this image of the central character, the real script was called Hogan's Alley. Supposed to be the street. Right. But it's really the Yellow Kid. Everyone called it the Yellow Kid because of this strange little beady eyed, bald headed kid with his yellow nightshirt that Outcult would write stuff on. You know?
Was his name Mickey Dugan?
His name was Mickey Dugan, exactly. And like we're saying, you know, everyone called him the Yellow Kid, but he was definitely Mickey Dugan. And he was, you know, one of these sort of kids running wild in the streets and doing things and, you know, getting a chance to kind of address the audience, look out at them and tell them whatever message Outcall wanted at a particular time. And he became a huge merchandising character, too, which is also part of this. Yeah.
But it was first of all, it's a big full-page comic, one single image with all sorts of stuff going on. It was the first speech balloon use?
It wasn't technically, you know, a lot of these, I'm always, as a cultural historian, always leery about saying things like first.
Okay, I totally get that.
It doesn't seem to have been the first, but it really kind of combines a lot of the things that kind of were here and there. So a combination of the speech balloon and, you know, the panel and the captions and the continuing characters and all of these kinds of things to really kind of become what we think of as comics now. Really, really important in that kind of way.
Let's just go over a couple of these of the comics from this sort of first era of comics. The Cats and Jammer Kids. That was a strip to me that was aimed at immigrants too.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, first, you know, there was a significant, in terms of, you know, there was a significant German-American immigrant population, right? And this was really taken from a German comic called Max and Moritz. So, you know, there really was that kind of immigrant connection here. And it was, you know, it had this kind of German dialect kind of in it, a German, you know, English dialect. And also, it was aimed at these kids, right? It was a comic strip that featured kids. but it was also about, you know, this sort of wacky kind of slapstick adventuring and mischief that these Cassishammer kids could get up to that really, you know, anybody could enjoy. And it appealed to everybody, I think, in a lot of ways.
Was there, from the beginning, was there always some kind of moral concern about comics, that the stuff being shown in the comics was like, I know in the Cats and Jammer Kids, the kids are always doing nasty stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, I'm now actually just reading this great biography of Buster Keaton, the silent film comedian that's about to come out. And, you know, right around the time that the Cats and Jammer Kids are coming out, there's this real concern about sort of child safety and child morality. Think of the children, all this stuff, right? Because the young Buster Keaton was in this act as a kid where he was literally thrown around by his parents. It's a crazy thing. But it does seem that in the history of American culture, there are these moral panics that come around and around every few decades, right? With, you know, anything new, everyone says, but think of the children. And that's certainly the case. Certainly the case here. Certainly the case right at the beginning.
Go on. Oh, I wanted to change lanes a little bit and talk about Little Nemo in Slumberland, Winsor McKay. That comic, which has been out now in full-size reproductions now, has been published a couple of decades ago. That still, for me, is visually stunning. That, I mean, Winsor McKay himself was important in the history of animation, but that comic is just wild looking.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you had to pick one figure, I mean, thankfully, as you say, thanks to these wonderful renaissance in collected editions, we don't have to. But if you had to pick one figure to save from the flop jetsam of that early 20th century, I would pick McKay in a heartbeat, because he really is expanding. Wild is the word for it. He's expanding sort of the capacities of what comics are in these just amazing, beautifully drawn, entirely surreal, you know, full-page Sunday comics of what really comics can do, which is to put a dream on the page. And that's what this Little Nemo in Slumberland does. Every week, Little Nemo falls asleep, and he goes to this place called Slumberland and has these just kind of incredible, bizarre, wild adventures. And then he wakes up until next Sunday when he continues where he left off. And it's this just, you know, incredible use of the page, of the medium, that I think, you know, in many ways has been unmatched today, but certainly has very few equals at the time.
But as you mentioned, and it wasn't until I read you on this that I realized this is true, McKay's ultimate legacy in this strip lay in the image, not the narrative.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And in fact, you know, the Cats and Jammer Kids that we've talked about, that was a big hit. The Yellow Kid was a big hit. Little Nemo and Slumberland never really got the kind of audience popularly, sort of, you know, people didn't, even though it was a continuing serial in some ways, people never really got into the narrative at the time. They just, it wasn't really quite clear because it had a kid protagonist. Was it aimed at kids? Was it aimed at adults? Who was it aimed at? Didn't really quite work. But as an artistic achievement, I think it's very, very high.
As is Crazy Cat by George Harriman. Yes. I think that even more for me than Little Nemo, Crazy Cat, just the use of language in Crazy Cat is bizarre. But as you write, Little Nemo and Crazy Cat weren't popular at that time.
That's right. And Crazy Cat, I mean, is a very interesting, right? If it weren't for the owner of this newspaper chain, William Randolph Hearst, that Crazy Cat appeared in, who was really of these kind of moguls, one of the big comics lovers. He really genuinely loved the form. And he would save these comics, you know, because he liked them, right? And no one was going to, you know, cross Mr. Hearst on his own newspaper chain. So if it weren't for him, we certainly would not have had the long run of Crazy Cat that we do, because it really does not make itself necessarily user-friendly in a certain kind of way. That's not what it's about. It's about sort of, you know, Harriman's individual genius playing itself out in this sort of bizarre linguistic way, you know, and among other things. And he does it magnificently.
We're barely covering anything that you cover in the book. I want to talk about the Depression, and comics really sort of start to come of age. You have strips like Dick Tracy, you have Harold Foster's Tarzan, Buck Rogers, all that stuff starts to pour out. These incredible continued stories are just amazing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you've hit on that really next big technological development when you're saying that word continued, right? Which is that at this point, you know, and part of this was a business decision. One of my favorite quotes from a newspaper editor at the time is, "You're not trying to get them to read today's paper; they already own today's paper. You're trying to get them to read tomorrow's paper."
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and the way you do that is, you know, you have a hook, you have a serial, you have a continuing adventure. You got to buy that next paper to read the, you know, to read the continuing of the story. And so things like Dick Tracy, you know, really are saying we just want this continuing adventure to go on. Little Orphan Annie, things like that, where people are just totally invested in this. And I think that, you know, even when we talk nowadays about sort of, you know, superhero comics or Marvel movies, I think we can't almost conceive of how integrated these comic characters were into American life. Everybody was reading these and sort of keeping up on the adventures of these particular people. And it was a kind of depression escapism in all sorts of different ways. And, you know, what kind of escapism it was depended on whether you were reading Little Orphan Annie, you know, or Buck Rogers, right? Those were two very different kinds of escapism. But, you know, it was a tough time, and people looked to these comics in some ways for, you know, the 30 seconds it took to read one strip and the 5 minutes it took to read the comics pages to you know, get a little bit away from their troubles. That's what it seems.
There's a great section in your book. It's just, I think it's about two paragraphs long, about comics contributing to the American language. And there are all sorts of phrases that originated in comics that are now in popular use.
Yeah, it was, I have to say that sort of, you know, doing the research for those couple of paragraphs, it was amazing to me how many of these you know, ended up being part of it, you know, ranging from Casper Milk to, I mean, some the heebie-jeebie, you know, even some cartoonists became names, you know, that Rube Goldberg contraption. I think people certainly have used that in the last few decades, having never seen an actual Rube Goldberg.
Right. They have no idea what the reference is to.
Right. You know, and you know, just these ramshackle, but just brilliantly put together panel by Rube Goldberg, you know, of these cartoons that sort of have an incredible amount of sophisticated or incredible amount of complicated machinery to do something extremely simple, like, you know, rock your chair back and forth or something like that.
Now, we're skipping over so much material, but I want to get to the idea of a comic book.
Yeah.
Why? Why did comic books start? And how did they start? And what were the first things that were printed as comic books?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I think, again, what people often, looking backwards through the century plus, you know, don't think about is, you know, the business side of this and how it comes really out of comic strips, right? So you're in, you know, the early to mid-1930s, and you're saying, you know, this is these comic strips, there's one problem with them, right? Which is people love these stories that we're talking about, but, you know, they read Monday's paper and then they throw it out, or they use it to wrap fish in or line their garbage cans, right? It's gone, right? I mean, but what if they want to reread it? So they really start out, these comic books, as books, sometimes real books, sometimes, you know, pamphlets, of put together old comic strips so that you would have them. And that was the first real thing of them. There was no idea that there would be any kind of originality in them, right? But pretty soon, some people said, you know what? I bet there could be a business in having all new material in these comic books. And especially because being a comic strip cartoonist was actually pretty high status, socially speaking, and it was it could be very lucrative, right? So there were lots of people who wanted to be in that business. And, of course, many of them didn't get to be. There was only so much space in the newspapers. And so there was a ton of aspiring cartoonists wanting to do this. And two of those people were Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, these two kids from Cleveland. They shop this Superman that they come up with everywhere. It doesn't work. And so finally they put it in this sort of cheap second status, you know, comic book. And then, of course, it, you know, we know the story from there, right? And it just changes the world.
What's amazing is that starts this sort of torrent of superheroes. And you, in rapid succession, you have things like the Batman, Plastic Man, and then some of them, a lot of them that never really made it into their second sort of second life. There's some really strange ones. And then the stories of each of those are really weird. Like Wonder Woman's William Moulton Marston and his passion for bondage.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, for, you know, the first part of what you're saying, you know, absolutely. It's like any business, right? No, you know, nobody knows who's going to be first, but everybody wants to be second. You know, they see there's a ton of money in these costumed heroes, right? And so there's like, you know, some of them become, you know, immortal, and some of them are lost to history, you know, even by the standards of what I put in the book, right? There are plenty of others that didn't even make it there. And then, you know, a lot of them have, you know, creators who have very similar backgrounds. A lot of them are Jewish. A lot of them,
that's right,
you know, are immigrants or immigrants' kids. A lot of them come up, you know, from the streets. They don't have a lot of formal education. And then there was William Moulton Marston, right, who was a lecturer at Harvard, who was, you know, not Jewish, who had, you know, was a psychologist who was brought in because of some of, at first, because of some of those moral panic type things that we talked about. And then creates this Wonder Woman character. And in it, he has, you know, he imports some of the aspects of his extremely idiosyncratic personal life, to put it mildly. And he includes in it, it's very clear that, you know, some aspects of sadomasochism, of, you know, of bondage and all these kinds of things. You know, it's probably the case that there were, you know, quite a number of people who were attracted to Wonder Woman, at least in some part, because of, you know, that sort of divergent aspect of it.
Well, this also brings up an interesting question about the role of women in the history of comics. As artists or as inkers or whatever, you have people like Tarpe Mills and Miss Fury, but there's not a lot. And also black comics were definitely a thing, and they were printed in black newspapers at the time, which, by the way, you do the whole history of that.
I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the things that I was trying to really talk about, at least to a certain extent, but, you know, really be part of the story, was things that had been, you know, erased either from the histories of some comic books, you know, or some comic book stories, and also erased because they were just not allowed to be included in different kinds of things, or included, but in these kind of stereotypical ways, right? So, and in many ways, this was no different than a lot of other kind of popular culture movements at the time, right? So so first, as you say, you know, there was this, you know, there were not a lot of black characters on the pages of the comic, on the newspaper comics pages of, let's say, the World or the Sun or the Herald or things like that. But there was a whole chain of black newspapers. There was a whole circuit of black newspapers. They had comic strips of their own. Some of them were really, you know, extremely popular, you know, in black communities, and were, you know, extremely aesthetically ambitious as well. In terms of, you know, women sort of participating, it's also a very interesting story, both as characters and, as you say, as sort of behind the scenes. Some of that really reflected trends in sort of American employment and American culture. As, you know, Superman is in 1938, so it's only, an eye blink after that, that we have sort of the American male labor shortage because of World War II, and we have a lot of women sort of coming into the workplace in ways that maybe they hadn't been before, and they are taking a more active role in working on, you know, on the new American comic books, and some of that gets pushed back again, you know, after the war. And then we have sort of some of these, like Tarpe Mills, we have some of these characters, you know, people who really are just sort of part of the whole landscape. And I think that's reflected in some of these representations, too. You have Lois Lane, who comes out of this kind of Rosalind Russell, Catherine Hepburn 1930s. Very different character than she is in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And that's part of the story, too, yeah.
We have just literally a few minutes left, and I just want to give a shout-out to Will Eisner.
Glad you did, yeah.
And The Spirit. Luckily, I think it was about in the 70s, The Spirit was reprinted, and you could collect all those issues, which I did.
Amazing.
Yeah, but that was Eisner's, especially his splash page, his artwork, was just astounding. And it really was a comic that started to be more for adults.
So, yeah, Will Eisner is a phenomenally interesting individual who really recurs, as you say, sort of at these different points through the history of comics, but very, very important. And in some ways, you know, he's responsible for two very different things in comics at the same time in this dawn of the comic book era. He's one of the people who's the most responsible for this kind of assembly line system of comics, where you have, you know, one person doing the penciling and one person doing the inking and one person doing the coloring and sort of these panels that are kind of laid out, this more kind of shop system. But on the other hand, he's also responsible for saying, you know, I really think that these comic books can have a kind of ambition you know, they aren't right now. And he has the opportunity to kind of put this into practice, as you're saying, when he has the opportunity to sort of present a kind of comic book insert for a newspaper, which presumably is going to have sort of a wider and maybe older audience. And the title of the section was often known as the spirit section because of this sort of quasi-superhero that he creates. But the most important thing about that was, because it was kind of this comic book insert, you could have a full-page cover, so to speak. And he would design these amazing full-page spirit covers that really just used light and shadow and the full page in these kind of really aesthetically ambitious ways. They're not surreal, usually, like Winsor McCay that we were talking about before.
Right.
But in some ways, they do feel McKay-esque in that kind of artistic way. And it really is saying, boy, that's something different. And as you say, in the 1970s, when the comic book is in an entirely different place, they're looking back to Eisner and saying, yes, that ambition matters.
And that's why there's an award named after him.
Absolutely. They're the Oscars of comics. They're called
the Eisners. We're completely out of time. We barely scratched the surface of the section of the book that we talked about. My guest tonight is author Jeremy Dauber. He's a professor of Jewish literature and American studies at Columbia University. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's a mammoth history and really fun to read. American Comics, A History. We're going to have him back to talk more. Jeremy, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. I can't wait.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.